31. In one of my earlier notebooks, I made painstaking copies from Sir George Grey's journal, written in the 1830s. Grey was perhaps the first white explorer to understand that, despite occasional discomforts, the Aboriginals lived well. The best passage in the journal is a description of a black fellow straining all his physical and mental faculties to stalk and spear a kangaroo. The last paragraph winds into a coda. His graceful movements, cautious advance, the air of quietude and repose which pervade his frame when his prey is alarmed, all involuntarily call forth your imagination and compel you to murmur to yourself, "How beautiful! How very beautiful!" I fooled myself into believing that some of this beauty must survive, even today. I asked Rolf to find a man to take me hunting. I had been sitting on my ass for a couple of weeks and was beginning to feel the disgust for words that comes from taking no exercise.
"The best man to go with," said Rolf, "would be old Alex Changapati. He speaks some English."
Alex was an elderly man who wore his hair up in ochre string and a lady's plum velvet overcoat with padded shoulders. I don't think he had anything on underneath. He went bushwalking every day, and in the evenings he'd hang about the store with his hunting spears, staring at the rest of the Cullen mob as though they were the real canaille. When Rolf asked him to take me, Alex pulled a long, regretful face and walked away.
"Well, that," I said, "is that." "Never mind," he said, "we'll find someone else."
Around noon next day, Stumpy Jones drove the truck into Cullen. He was the first to make it through the flood. Even so, he'd got bogged for a day and a night this side of Popengie, and the Magellan mining boys had to haul him out. There was a girl with him. She was the girlfriend of Don, the works manager.
"And she's a good girl," said Stumpy, winking.
She had cropped hair and a dirty white dress. Don seemed very pleased to see her, but she gave him a cool, appraising glance and continued to smile at Stumpy.
"Right," she said, "I don't whinge about being bogged."
Don and I helped unload the crates off the truck. We had almost finished when Rolf came out.
"You want to go hunting?" he called.
"Yes," I said.
"You want to pay for a full tank of petrol?"
"If that's what they want."
"I've fixed it."
"Who with?"
"Donkey Donk," he said. "Good bloke."
"When?"
"Now," he said. "You'd better go and get your boots on, and a hat."
I was walking across to the caravan when a rattle-trap Ford sedan came creaking and groaning up behind. At the wheel was a bearded Aboriginal with a big belly.
"You going a-hunting?"
he grinned. "With you?"
"Man," said Donkey Donk.
We drove back to get the petrol, but the moment the tank was paid for, I realized my role in this expedition was not that of client, but slave. Donkey Donk made me buy extra oil, bullets, candy bars, cigarettes. He wanted me to buy him a new tire. He made me hold his cigarette while he tinkered with the engine. We were all set to go when a young man called Walker strolled up. Walker was a great traveller. He'd travelled up and down Australia on a most fastidious search for a wife. He had also spent time in the Amsterdam YMCA. He was very beautiful. He had a godlike profile and very dark skin. His hair and beard were the colour of spun gold.
"You want to come hunting?"
Donkey Donk called to him.
"Sure,"
said Walker, and sat down in the back seat. We drove off to find the man who had the gun. He was another incredibly graceful young man, with a feckless smile and hair down to his shoulders. He was sitting outside a brushwood shelter. He had scrawled his name, Nero, in red ballpoint all over his jeans. Nero's wife, it turned out, was the giantess I had watched playing poker. She was a good head taller than he, and about four times as wide. She was sitting behind her shelter by the campfire, gnawing at a charred kangaroo ham. When Nero got into the car, their small son rushed after him and did a high dive through the open window. The mother followed, waving her kangaroo bone bludgeon. She dragged the boy out by the hair and spat in his face. We had been going a couple of minutes when Nero turned to the others.
"Got the matches?"
he asked. Donkey Donk and Walker shook their heads. We turned round to fetch some matches.
"Smokes," Nero grinned, "case we get bogged."
We headed south between Mounts Cullen and Liebler and dropped down towards the Gunbarrel Highway. After the rain, the scrub was breaking into yellow flowers. The track began and ended in a mirage, and the chain of rocky hills appeared to float above the plain. I pointed to a reddish outcrop on the left. "So what's that one?" I asked.
"Oh, man,"
Walker volunteered brightly. "So where's this old man coming from?"
"Come long way, around the mob, maybe. Maybe Sydney."
"And where's he going to?"
"Port Hedland," he said decisively.
Port Hedland is an iron ore port on the coast of Western Australia, about 800 miles west of Cullen, beyond the Gibson Desert. "And what happens to that old man," I asked, "when he gets to the sea?"
"End of him," said Walker. "Finish."
I next pointed to a low, flat-topped hill, which, Rolf had assured me, was a lump of shit the Parenti man had shat in the dreamtime.
"And what about that one?"
Walker fumbled nervously with his beard.
"I'm too young," he said bashfully,
by which he meant he had not been initiated into that particular song.
"Ask Nero," he went on. "He knows it."
Nero sniggered and tilted his head from side to side.
"Toilet dreaming," he said. "Shit dreaming."
Donkey Donk was splitting his sides with laughter and swerving all over the track. I turned to face the two on the back seat.
"Parenti shit?" I asked.
"No, no," Nero giggled foolishly. "Two men."
"And where do those two men come from?"
"Coming from nowhere," he flapped his hands. "Doing it there."
Nero made a sign with his thumb and forefinger, making it all too plain what the two men were up to.
"Brothers-in-law," he said.
Walker frowned, pursed his lips, and pressed his knees tight together.
"I don't believe you," I said to Nero. "You're having me on."
"Hee-hee," he laughed, and let fly another helpless peal of giggles. He and Donkey Donk were still snorting with laughter when, a mile or so farther on, we stopped by some low-lying rocks. All three jumped out of the car.
"Come on,"
Nero called to me.
"Water."
There were pools of stagnant water among the rocks, and mosquito larvae wriggling about in them.
"Tapeworms," said Nero.
"Not tapeworms," I said. "Mosquito larvae."
"Dingo," said Donkey Donk.
He gestured towards the largest rock, which really did look like a dog lying down. The smaller rocks, he said, were puppies. They splashed around in the water for several minutes. We then quit the track and headed west across country. Donkey Donk, I have to say, was an astounding driver. He put the car into a kind of dance through the spine effects. He knew exactly whether to swerve round a bush or flatten it. The seed heads showered onto the windscreen. Nero kept the barrel of his .22 sticking out of the window.
"Turkey track," he whispered.
Donkey Donk braked, and a bush turkey, which is a kind of bustard, craned its mottled brown head above the grass stems and made off at a trot. Nero fired once, and the bird collapsed in a whirl of flying feathers.
"Good shot," I said.
"Another one," shouted Walker,
and a second turkey ran on ahead into a thicket. Nero fired again and missed. By the time we got back to the first turkey, it too had vanished.
"Fucking turkey," said Nero.
We held our course to the west, and before long, a kangaroo and young leaped up in front of us. Donkey Donk put his foot on the accelerator, and the car thumped and bounced over the tussocks, with the kangaroos bounding on ahead, gaining. Then we were out of the spine effects, into burnt and open country, and we were gaining, and we caught up and hit the mother in the haunches. The young one had veered off sideways, and she flew in a backward somersault over the roof of the car and landed, dead, I prayed, in a cloud of dust and ash. We jumped out. Nero fired into the cloud, but the kangaroo was up and off, shaky, limping, yet with a fair burst of speed, and Donkey Donk alone at the wheel now, at her tail. We watched the car slam into the kangaroo a second time, but she landed on the bonnet, jumped clear, and came bounding in our direction. Nero took a couple of swinging shots, but missed. They zinged into the bush beside me, and the kangaroo zigzagged back the way she'd come. Donkey Donk then headed off and hit her a third time with an awful thud, and this time she didn't budge. He opened the car door and clouted the base of her skull with a spanner, at which she reared up again on her haunches, and he had to grab her by the tail. By the time we three ran up, The kangaroo was hopping forward, and Donkey Donk was hanging on like a man in a tug of war, and then Nero put a shot through her head, and that was that. Walker looked disgusted and miserable.
I don't like it, he said.
Nor do I agreed. Nero contemplated the dead kangaroo. A stream of blood trickled from her nostrils onto the red earth.
Old one, he shrugged. Not good for eat.
What are you going to do with her?
Leave, he said. Cut off tail, maybe. You got a knife?
No, I said. Nero rummaged in the car and found the lid of an old tin can. Using it as a blade, he tried to cut off the tail, but couldn't saw through the vertebrae. The back left tire had a flat. Donkey Donk commanded me to get out the jack and change the wheel. The jack was badly bent, and when I applied a few strokes of pressure, it snapped, and the axle hit the dirt.
Now you've done it,
he leered. What do we do? I asked.
Walk, said Nero with a titter.
How far?
2 days, maybe.
What about the smoke? I suggested.
Nah, growled Donkey Donk. Lift him. Lift him up, man.
Walker and I gripped the bumper, braced our backs, and tried to lift, while Donkey Donk got ready with a log to shove under the differential. It was no use.
Come on, I shouted at Nero. Give us a hand.
He cupped his fingers and ran them up and down one of his slender biceps, batting his eyelids and giggling.
No force, he said breathlessly.
Donkey Donk handed me a digging stick and ordered me to scoop out a hole beneath the wheel. Half an hour later, the hole was big enough to change the wheel. All three looked on as I worked. I was done in and drenched with sweat. We then rocked the car back and forth and finally pushed it clear. We left the kangaroo to the crows and drove back to Cullen.
You want to come hunting tomorrow? Asked Donkey Donk.
No, I said. London, 1970. At a public lecture, I listened to Arthur Koestler airing his opinion that the human species was mad. He claimed that as a result of an inadequate coordination between two areas of the brain, the rational neocortex and the instinctual hypothalamus, man had somehow acquired the unique, murderous, delusional streak that propelled him, inevitably, to murder, to torture, and to war. Our prehistoric ancestors, he said, did not suffer from the effects of overcrowding. They were not short of territory. They did not live in cities. Yet they butchered one another just the same. He went on to say that since Hiroshima, there had been a total transformation of the structure of human consciousness, in that, for the first time in his history, man had to contemplate the idea of his destruction as a species. This millenarian claptrap made me quite angry. At question time, I stuck up my hand. Around the year 1000, I said, people all over Europe believed that a violent end of the world was imminent. How was the structure of their consciousness any different from our own? Koestler fixed me with a contemptuous stare, and, to the approval of the audience, snapped,
Because one was fantasy, and the H-bomb is real.
Salutary reading for the end of the second millennium. Henri Faucillon's L'An Mille. In his chapter, The Problem of the Terrors, Faucillon shows how exactly 1,000 years ago, Western man was paralyzed by the same set of fears being put about today by the bigots who pass for statesmen. The phrase mundus senescit, the world grows old, reflected a mood of dire intellectual pessimism, as well as a religious conviction that the world was a living body which, having passed the peak of its maturity, was doomed suddenly to die. The sources of the terror were threefold. One, that God would destroy his creation in clouds of fire and brimstone. Two, that the legions of the devil would erupt out of the east. Three, that epidemics would wipe out the human race. And yet the terror passed. The year 1000 came and went, and the new open society of the Middle Ages took root. As Bishop Glaber wrote in the loveliest of lines, 3 years after the year 1000, the earth was covered with a white robe of churches. Dinner party, London, 1971. A very tall American came to dinner. He was on his way to Washington from a fact-finding mission in Vietnam. Over the past week, he had flown to Hawaii, to Guam, to Tokyo and Saigon. He had overflown Hanoi on a bombing raid. He had conferred with NATO chiefs of staff and this was his one night off. He was an innocent man. Over salad he spoke of defoliants. I shall not forget the sight of raspberries passing between his lips, nor the thud of stressed syllables coming out of them.
The North Vietnamese have lost between a half and a third of a generation of their young fighting men. This is a loss no nation can afford to sustain indefinitely, which is why we anticipate a military victory in Vietnam in the course of 1972.
From Sun Tzu's The Art of War, do not press an enemy at bay. Prince Phu Chai said, wild beasts, when at bay, fight desperately. How much more is this true of men? If they know there is no alternative, they will fight to the death. Steiermark, Austria, 1974. Hiking in the Rottenmeier Tauern, before my interview with Lorenz, my rucksack waited with his books. The days were cloudless. I spent each night in a different alpine hut and had sausages and beer for supper. The mountainsides were in flower, gentians and edelweiss, columbines and the Turk's cap lily. The pine woods were blue-green in the sunlight, and streaks of snow still lingered on the screes. On every meadow there were mild brown cows, the cowbells clanking and echoing across the valleys, or the chime of a church bell far below. Hölderlin's line, in lovely blueness blooms the steeple with its metal roof. The hikers, men and women in red and white shirts and lederhosen, and everyone calling Grüß Gott as they passed. One naughty little man mistook me for a German and, with a leer of a pornography salesman, reversed his jacket collar to show me his swastikas. Rereading Lorenz made me realize why sensible people tended to throw up their hands in horror, to deny there was such a thing as human nature, and to insist that everything must be learnt. Genetic determinism, they felt, threatened every liberal, human and democratic impulse to which the West still clung. They recognized, too, that you couldn't pick and choose with instincts. You had to take the lot. You couldn't allow Venus into the pantheon and bolt the door on Mars. And once you took on fighting, territorial behavior and rank order, you were back in the soup of 19th century reaction. What, in On Aggression, caught the fancy of the Cold War warriors was Lorenz's concept of ritual combat. The superpowers, by implication, must fight because it is in their nature to fight, yet could perhaps contain their squabbles in some poor, small, preferably defenseless country, just as two bucks will choose a patch of no man's land to spar on. The U.S. Secretary of Defense, I was told, kept an annotated copy by his bedside. Men are products of their situation, and learning conditions everything they will ever say or think or do. Children are traumatized by events in their childhood, nations by crises in their history, but could this conditioning mean there are no absolute standards which transcend historical memories, no rights or wrongs, regardless of race or creed? Has the gift of tongues somehow done away with instinct? Is man, in short, the proverbial blank slate of the behaviorists, infinitely malleable and adaptive? If so, then all the great teachers have been spouting hot air. The most objectionable passage in On Aggression, or the one that led to catcalls of Nazi, is one in which Lorenz describes the instinctive, fixed motor pattern observable in young soldiers roused to battle fury. The head held high, chin stuck out, the arms rotated inwards, the shiver down the now non-existent hair along the spine. One soars elated above the cares of everyday life. Men enjoy the feeling of absolute righteousness, even when they commit atrocities. And yet, the mother who fights in fury to defend her child is, one would hope, obeying the call of instinct, not the advice of some maternal guidance leaflet. And if you allow the existence of fighting behavior in young women, why not also in young men? Instincts are Pascal's reasons of the heart of which the reason knows nothing. And to believe in the reasons of the heart holds no comfort whatsoever for the reactionary, very much the reverse. Without religion, in Dostoevsky's famous formulation, everything is permissible. Without instinct, everything would be equally permissible. A world shorn of instinct,
would be a far more deadly and dangerous place than anything the aggression mongers could come up with, for here would be limbo land, where everything could be capped by something else. Good could be bad. Sense, nonsense. Truth, lies. Knitting, no more moral than child murder. And where a man might be brainwashed into thinking or saying or doing whatever might be pleasing to the powers that be. A torturer can cut off a man's nose, but if the man gets a chance to breed, his child will be born with a nose. So with instinct. A core of unmodifiable instinct in man means that the brainwashers must begin their work of distortion over and over again, with each individual and each generation, and this, in the end, is a very wearisome business. The Greeks believed there were limits to the range of human behavior. Not, as Camus pointed out, that these limits would never be surpassed, simply that they existed, arbitrarily, and that whoever had the hubris to exceed them would be struck down by fate. Lorenz maintains there are certain crises, or instinctual Rubicons, in the life of any animal when it receives a call to behave in a certain way. The call is not necessarily taken up, for if the natural target of its behavior is missing, the animal will redirect it onto a substitute and grow up warped. Every mythology has its version of the hero and his road of trials, in which a young man, too, receives a call. He travels to a distant country, where some giant or monster threatens to destroy the population. In a superhuman battle, he overcomes the power of darkness, proves his manhood, and receives his reward, a wife, treasure, land, fame. These he enjoys into late middle age, when once again the clouds darken, again restlessness stirs him, again he leaves, either like Beowulf to die in combat, or, as the blind Tiresias prophesies for Odysseus, to set off for some mysterious destination and vanish. Catharsis, Greek for purging or cleansing. One controversial etymology derives it from the Greek kathero, to rid the land of monsters. Myth proposes, action disposes. The hero's cycle represents an unchangeable paradigm of ideal behavior for the human male. One could, of course, work out one for the heroine. Each section of the myth, like a link in a behavioral chain, will correspond to one of the classic ages of man. Each age opens with some fresh barrier to be scaled or ordeal to be endured. The status of the hero will rise in proportion as to how much of this assault course he completes or is seen to complete. Most of us, not being heroes, dawdle through life, mistime our cues, and end up in our various emotional messes. The hero does not. The hero, and this is why we hail him as a hero, takes each ordeal as it comes and chalks up point after point. I once made the experiment of slotting the career of a modern hero, Che Guevara, onto the structure of the Beowulf epic. The result was, with a bit of tinkering here and there, that both heroes are seen to perform the same set of exploits in the same sequence. The leave-taking, the voyage across the sea, the defeat of the monster, Grendel, Batista, the defeat of the monster's mother, the water hag, the Bay of Pigs. Both heroes receive their reward, a wife, fame, treasure, in Guevara's case a Cuban wife, and the directorship of the National Bank of Cuba, and so forth. Both end up dying in a distant country, Beowulf killed by the scaly worm, Guevara by the dictator of Bolivia. As a man, Guevara, for all his charm, strikes one as a ruthless and unpleasant personality. As a hero, he never put a foot wrong, and the world chose to see him as a hero. Heroes in moments of crisis are said to hear angel voices telling them what to do next. The whole of the Odyssey is a marvelous tug-of-war between Athene whispering in Odysseus's ear, "Yes, you'll make it," and Poseidon roaring, "No, you won't!" And if you swap the word instinct for angel voice, you come close to the more psychologically minded mythographers, that myths are fragments of the soul life of early man. The hero's cycle, wherever found, is a story of fitness in the Darwinian sense, a blueprint for genetic success. Beowulf leaves, Ivan leaves, Jack leaves, the young aboriginal on walkabout leaves.
even the antique Don Quixote leaves, and these Vanda Yara and combats with the beast are the storyteller's version of the incest taboo, whereby a man must first prove fitness and then must marry far. In practice, it scarcely matters whether myths are the coded messages of instinct, whose structures will reside in the central nervous system, or tales of instruction handed down from the year dot. One point cannot be emphasized too strongly. Seldom, if ever, in myth is it desirable morally for a man to kill a man in cold blood. Among the military fraternities of ancient Germany, a young man, as part of his training to stifle inhibitions against killing, was required to strip naked, to dress himself in the hot, freshly flayed skin of a bear, to work himself into a bestial rage, in other words, to go, quite literally, berserk. Bearskin and berserk are the same word. The helmets of the royal guards, on duty outside Buckingham Palace, are the descendants of this primitive battle costume. Homer distinguishes two kinds of fighting behavior. One is Menos, the cold-blooded stand of Odysseus as he shoots the suitors. The other is Lissa, or wolfish rage, such as possesses Hector on the battlefield. Iliad, chapter 9, lines 237-9. A man in the thrall of Lissa is thought to be no longer human, or subject to the laws of earth and heaven. Lorenz's militant fighting enthusiasm is a description of Lissa. The Sioux Indians are a set of miserable, dirty, lousy, blanketed, thieving, lying, sneaking, murdering, graceless, faceless, gut-eating skunks, as the Lord ever permitted to infect the earth, and whose immediate and final extermination all men, excepting Indian agents and traders, should pray for. From the Topeka Weekly Daily, 1869. The stranger, if he be not a trader, is an enemy. Old English. The Middle Latin wargus, i.e. expulsus or stranger, is also the same as the wolf, and thus the two conceptions, that of the wild beast to be hunted down and that of the man to be treated as a wild beast, are intimately associated. P.J. Hamilton Grierson, The Silent Trade. Nuristan, Afghanistan, 1970. The villages of Nuristan are set at so vertiginous an angle to the mountainsides that ladders of deodar wood must serve the function of streets. The people have fair hair and blue eyes and carry battle axes made of brass. They wear pancake hats, cross gartering on their legs, and a dollop of coal on each eyelid. Alexander mistook them for a tribe of long-lost Greeks, the Germans for a tribe of Aryans. Our porters were a cringing lot, forever complaining that their poor feet could carry them no farther, and casting envious eyes on our boots. At 4 o'clock they wanted us to camp beside some sunless and broken houses, but we insisted on moving up the valley. An hour later we came to a village surrounded by walnut trees. The rooftops were orange, from apricots drying in the sun, and girls in rose madder dresses were playing in a field of flowers. The village headman welcomed us with a frank and open smile. We were then joined by a bearded young satyr, his hair wreathed in vine leaves and meadow sweet, who offered us, from his leather flask, a thread of sharp white wine. "Here," I said to the leading porter, "we will stop."
"We will not stop," he said.
He had learned his English in the Peshawar Bazaar. "We will stop," I said.
"These people are wolves," he said.
"Wolves?"
"They are wolves."
"And the people of that village?" I asked, pointing to a second, dejected-looking village about a mile upstream.
"They are people," he said.
"And the village beyond that? Wolves, I suppose?"
"Wolves,"
he nodded. "What nonsense you do talk."
"Not nonsense, Sahib," he said. "Some people are people and some other people are wolves."
It does not take too much imagination to suppose that man as a species has suffered some tremendous ordeal in his evolutionary past. The fact that he scraped through so brilliantly is a measure of the magnitude of the threat.
To prove this is another matter.
Yet already 20 years ago, I felt that far too much attention was being paid to our supposedly fratricidal tendencies, and too little to the role of the carnivore in shaping our character and destiny. If one had to give a general answer to the question, "What do carnivores eat?" it would be a very simple one. What they can get. Griff Ewer, the carnivores. It has been said of the Kadars, a hunting tribe of southern India, that they were strangers to violence or displays of virility because they channeled all their antipathies outwards onto the tiger. Suppose, for the sake of argument, you cut all the loose talk of aggression and focused on the problem of defense. What if the adversary on the plains of Africa had not been the other man, not the men of the other tribe? What if the adrenal discharges that precipitate fighting fury had evolved to protect us from the big cats? What if our weapons were not primarily for hunting game, but for saving our skins? What if we were not so much a predatory species as a species in search of a predator? Or if at some critical watershed the beast had been about to win? Here, let there be no mistake, lies the great divide. If the first men had been brutish, murderous, cannibalistic, if their rapacity had driven them to acts of extermination and conquest, then any state, by providing an umbrella of force, will have saved men from themselves and must inevitably be considered beneficial. Such a state must, however frightful for the individual, be counted a blessing, and any action by individuals to disrupt, weaken, or threaten the state will be a step in the direction of primeval chaos. If, on the other hand, the first men themselves were humbled, harried, besieged, their communities few and fragmented, forever gazing at the horizon whence help might come, clinging to life and one another through the horrors of the night, might not all the specific attributes we call human, language, song-making, food-sharing, gift-giving, intermarriage, this is to say all the voluntary graces, which bring equipoise to society, which suppress the use of force among its members, and which can only function smoothly if equivalence is the rule, might not all these have evolved as stratagems for survival, hammered out against tremendous odds, to avert the threat of extinction? Would they therefore be any less instinctual or directionless? Would not a general theory of defense explain more readily why offensive wars are, in the long run, unfightable? Why the bullies never win? Altenburg, Austria, 1974. It was too hot in Lorenz's study, and we moved into a summer house in the garden. Above the town towered the medieval castle of Greifenstein, a bastion of Christian Europe against the shifting world of Asiatic horsemen. Seeing him on his own ground made me realize that his views on fighting must in some way be coloured by having been brought up at the centre of a tremendous geopolitical drama. Why was it, I asked him, that so many people still found the theory of instinct, as applied to man, unstomachable? There are certain things, he said, with which one simply cannot cope, and one of them is plain stupidity. Please stop me if I'm wrong, I said, but when, in any animal, you isolate a block of behaviour, the first question to ask is, what for? How would this or that have helped to preserve the species in its original habitat? True, he nodded. A robin, I said, alluding to one of his experiments, on seeing another robin, or even a piece of red fluff, will move into the attack because red says territorial rival. He will. So the trigger which releases fighting in a robin is the sight of its own kind. Of course. Well, why, when it comes to fighting among men, must one or other of the fighters be not quite human? Don't you think that militant enthusiasm, as you describe it, might have evolved as a defensive reaction against the wild beasts? It could be, he answered thoughtfully. It could very well be. Before hunting a lion, the Maasai in Kenya drum up fighting enthusiasm quite artificially, like a Nazi music march. Yes. Fighting may have developed primarily against the wild beasts. Chimps, at the sight of a leopard, do the whole collective aggression stunt beautifully. But surely, I persisted, haven't we got the concepts of aggression and defense mixed up? Aren't we dealing with two entirely separate mechanisms? On the one hand, you have the aggressive rituals, which, in the case of human beings, are gift-giving, treaty-making, and kinship arrangements. Then you have defense. Surely against the beast. All war propaganda, I went on, proceeded on the assumption that you must degrade the enemy into something bestial, infidel, cancerous, and so on, or alternatively, your fighters must transform themselves into surrogate beasts, in which case men became their legitimate prey. Lorenz tugged at his beard, gave me a searching look, and said, ironically or not, I'll never know, "What you have just said is totally new."